Hey, tennis fans, you are listening to Match Point Canada, the official podcast of Tennis Canada. We're also members of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. I'm Ben Lewis, joined alongside Mike McIntyre for our 10th episode of the season. The first half of the Sunshine Double, Mike, is in the books. Indian Wells has come and gone with titles from Iga and Carlitos. And with Miami just getting underway, you had a chance to speak with their tournament director and fantastic former player, James Blake.
Yeah, great to have James Blake back on the podcast. We spoke with him in the fall of 2019. I had to go back and sort of see when that event was here in Toronto, that Champions event with him, Andy Roddick, Jim Courier, and Robbie Ginepri. And I forgot how all the matches played out, but James Blake ended up being the winner for the night.
Oh, yeah.
And although when I speak with him, you know, in this interview, he mentions that the tennis game is just not there anymore. And he's kind of got to get used to the fact that, you know, it's funny when we play sports, we always want to be improving. And for former professional athletes, professional tennis players, you're never going to be anywhere near as good as what you were when you were younger, even though, you know, 43 years old is not old by any stretch. But it was just an interesting sort of comment, one of many interesting comments he makes in the interview that I really sort of, you know, yeah, hit home for me, being that I'm the same age as him as well. That's where the similarities start and end. But it was great to have him back because he's just, I think, one of the, you know, voices of reason in the sport, someone that's very, very well respected. He was when he was on tour as a player, you know, just as much now as well in his role as tournament director in Miami. We talked about that role and his evolution in the job over the last 6 or 7 years, as well as his take on, you know, many other things going on in the tennis world these days. So it's great to have him back. Definitely one of our big guests for this year so far as we're 10 episodes in and the year's flying. There's so much great stuff to talk about. But why don't we have a listen to my chat with James Blake to start? This week, our guest on Matchpoint Canada is a former top five tennis player on the ATP. He's captured 10 career singles titles. He's a published author. I just recently finished one of his two books, and it was fantastic. He's a philanthropist, a role model, and also the tournament director of the Miami Open. James Blake, welcome back to Matchpoint Canada.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate especially you taking the time for us. I know when we kind of touched base early in the season, you were in Australia. And you said, hey, Mike, how about we wait until I'm back from all my duties here with commentary? And of course, here we are now at probably arguably one of the busiest times of the year for you. So I feel extra indebted to you. I guess let's start with that. The tournament is just about to begin as we air this episode. How excited are you for, I believe, your seventh year now as tournament director in Miami?
Yeah, seventh year, sixth tournament, because we missed a year with COVID. But very excited about it. One thing that's been great is every year we have the ability to add. And that was the big step we took by moving to the Hard Rock Stadium from Crandon Park. Crandon Park's unbelievable with the nostalgia. That's where I played. It was a phenomenal event there. But I feel like the tour kind of outgrew it with the big teams now, with as many people are showing up and hopefully more fans as well. It's just easier access and just better for everyone, hopefully, at the Hard Rock Stadium. So we're fortunate to have the creativity of and the initiative of Stephen Ross to even offer it and to think to put a tennis stadium inside a 60,000 seat football stadium. So to show the versatility of the site. And it's been a pleasure. It really has been a learning experience to start, and now feeling like I've kind of gotten settled in a little bit more and learned about the process on this side, as opposed to just being a player. It's been a lot of fun. And this year I'm looking forward to it again, continuing to learn, continuing to get better, and hopefully continuing to make the tournament one of the premier stops on the ATP and WTA tour, and everyone leaving saying we're so happy to have been in Miami.
It's definitely a unique venue, and it's great to hear that you're sort of settling into your groove now as you've been in the role for so many years. What was the hardest part when you got started? I mean, I could imagine many of the players were contemporaries of yours at the time, and I don't know if they're asking for special favors that they might not from a regular tournament director, but what was the challenge in the early going as you transitioned from being a player, and what's the most challenging part still today for you in the role?
Yeah, that is one of the big challenges, is when you're so familiar with all the players. It's good and bad. It's good because they understand that you're fighting for them. You're not going into the locker room to explain something to them out of someone that's never been there. So it really helps you. But in the same vein, when they come to you and ask, hey, come on, this is just for me. Let me get one extra badge. Let me get one extra this. Let me get a little bit more time on the practice court. And they expect hey, we've been friends before and I'm happy to help. And all that, you know, the answer is always going to be yes. And as much as I always want it to be yes, there's plenty of times I have to say no. And that's actually the toughest part for me. Even some of my friends and agent and other people when I was on tour joked that like the hardest thing I had to do was ever say no, because I wanted to say yes to everything. And so that's been probably the toughest thing is the fact that you do have to draw a line sometimes, and you have to say no, and you have to be a little more pragmatic instead of just saying, you know what, this is what I want to do because it's for my friends, it's for the people that I've seen, I've watched play now, or the people that I've played against. I know their coaches, I know their parents, I know, and you just can't say yes to everything. So you gotta be reasonable, and that at times can be difficult because you want to be a buddy to a lot of the people, and you really have to distance yourself from that. You can still be friendly with a lot of the players, but it's not just about a popularity contest or who you're friends with that gets the most or the best treatment out there.
Is it different for you now? I'm not trying to date you. I mean, we're about the same age here, same vintage. But now that it's been a few years that you've been retired, and there aren't nearly as many, obviously, players that you've played against. We don't have to count how many, but that's changed. Is it different for you in the role, and just even how you interact with the game, having less of the people you grew up playing with still out there?
Yeah, it definitely is a little different. I'm starting to, I've joked to some other people that I'm starting to know way more of the coaches than I am the players, because I played against a lot of the coaches now, which is funny. But I did get my first time last year a little bit of a reality check of one of the young WTA players that came to me with a complaint. That's part of what you deal with as a tournament director is, complaining about this, complaining about that. We want this, we want more of that, and getting to this complaint. And at one point she said, "Well, I don't think you even care about the players." And I continued having the discussion, and I then told the WTA later, just telling them what happened, and what the complaint was, and what we need to do to fix whatever happened. And I told them, she said, "You don't really care about the players." And I had to, keep a straight face. I didn't want to laugh, but I realized that she's so young that, and I told them, like, I don't think she has any idea that I played. I don't think she knows that I was a player at all. And
Right.
they cracked up and they said, "We're gonna tell her." I said, No, don't tell her. Just it's fine. I want to, I'll take it." So I'm getting that sense that within the next couple of years, there's gonna be a few more of those where they just see me as only a tournament director or a commentator and not a former player. So I've definitely distanced myself from that playing time, but there's still a few of the veterans out there that I've played against or that I know very well from my time on tour.
Well, I'm sure the young American players coming up definitely know who James Blake is. So you've still got a spot for many of them, I'm sure. Our tournament, our big tournament here in Canada, the National Bank Open, held in Montreal and Toronto. You remember, you played it many times. We're growing up a little bit, so to speak, not this year, but next year, as we move to a bigger playing field and more of a 2-week tournament, similar to what Miami has been through for a while. I'm just curious, in terms of growing to that size of a tournament, what are the pros and cons, and maybe do you have any advice for a tournament like ours as we're on the cusp of getting to that next level, so to speak?
Yeah, the pros are it gives a great product because the players aren't as packed in. It's not as compact, so you have to get such great matches in such a short amount of time. You have a great match, you maybe have a day off. And it also gives you the flexibility when you have issues with weather. You got a rain, you got a session that's almost completely rained out or completely rained out. You have a little bit of flexibility, a little bit of wiggle room to work that schedule the next day, as opposed to the 1 week event where there's just no room. You end up having to play two matches in a day or extend it even to a Monday or what you have to do with crazy weather situations. So that's a benefit. The downside is that for players, now this is 2 weeks of their year of the schedule, and you're only going to play so many weeks, you're going to play so many tournaments. Now you have to pack one big tournament, but it's into 2 weeks. So it's taking that time off. They expect to be, as a player, speaking from a player's perspective, like you want to be compensated because you're normally playing two tournaments in that time. So you have two opportunities for paychecks. So when the prize money goes up, then to me, it seems like they always think it's worth it because now we've got hopefully a better product because we're all well better rested. We've got time in between matches. The level of the field is very high, and the top players get buys, so they're happy about that. More players have the opportunity to get into a big event like this, into a Master Series when you got 96 instead of 64. So I think that really helps. But They expect that level of compensation to go up because it does take 2 weeks out of their year. And the ones who are frustrated by it are the ones that lose early. You lose early, and that was a big chunk of your schedule, especially when you got, for us, it's Indian Wells and Miami back to back. You got nearly 2 week tournaments, 10 day, 12 day tournaments. That's a lot if you're not doing well in those.
And here we've got back to back between, Canada and Cincinnati as well. So similar to the Sunshine Double. I know I've got a budget for extra childcare costs when I'm on site for 2 weeks starting next year, but I got a few months to work that out between my wife and the in-laws and my parents too. Fingers crossed. Since we're Canadian tennis podcast, although we got a lot of listeners south of the border, but I got to ask you, which Canadian tennis players, and maybe this is part of the reason we're growing up here too, because tennis is becoming so much more popular. I think Canada has kind of stamped its place as a tennis nation, winning both the Davis Cup and Billie Jean King Cup in back-to-back years. And man, when I was growing up, if you told me that was going to happen, I never would have believed it for a million years. So I'm just curious, who of the Canadian tennis players, male or female, excites you the most, either in how you engage with them as tournament director or what you see from their game on the court as well?
Well, I mean, I'll be fully transparent here. I've helped Denis Shapovalov a little bit and talked to him more extensively than any of the others. He's being coached by Matt Daly, a good friend of mine, and I'm just kind of there as a voice when he needs to talk, whether it's bigger picture stuff, mentality, not right now coming back from injury, and how to handle that. So he's the one that excites me the most because I see that talent. I see that he's such a really great human being, and so I definitely want to help any way I can because I see a lot of similarities in our game style and some of our personality, and some of the challenges with the injury in the middle of your career. So I definitely get excited seeing him play and hopefully getting back to where he was, what his level was. But I think it's really incredible what Canadian tennis has done, and to see Grand Slam champions with Andreescu out of it, and to see Davis Cup and Billie Jean King Cup, and to think, when I was playing, it was pretty much Danny Nestor, and that was about it for Canadian tennis. And now to have FAA and to have Shapovalov and Andreescu on the other side, and you had Jeanne Bouchard having so much success for a while there. It's pretty impressive to see what's going on and the future that it holds. I mean, I remember seeing Felix play in the Junior U.S. Open. I think I was there. That might have been one of the years I was doing one of my first years doing commentary. I think I was doing some of the updates for CNN and watching that junior final. And I think I tweeted out at the time, man, this is the future of tennis right here. This kid is incredible. And good to see how much success he's had. Obviously struggled a little bit the last 6 months, 8 months, but when he does put it together, I think he's going to be a force again on tour. So fun to see the young guys really coming into their own.
And they're still so young. There's so much time for them to continue to grow and develop. We think Felix especially, it feels like he's been around forever, but he's only like 22, 23 years old still, And I think back to when I was growing up, and yeah, no disrespect to Danny Nestor. I mean, he was the man in Canada literally for quite a number of years. But I grew up and it was like, oh, I wanted to be like Boris Becker or Stefan Edberg. And my kids now growing up and they want to be like Felix or Bianca or Leila Annie. And so it's just got such a huge impact here at home. In the States, you've got such a depth of tennis, both male and female. And it feels like on the men's side, it's kind of finally catching up and going through another cycle or a boom, if you will, with players like Taylor Fritz and Francis Tiafoe and Shelton. My goodness, does he ever get people pumped up for the sport as well? You must be pretty excited to see what's happening now, in terms of the American men. And does it almost feel as strong now as, I mean, it has been in several years since you were actively playing in terms of the parity between men's and women's tennis in the States right now?
Yeah, I think it's great to see the American men doing so well and having unbelievable depth. The number we have in the top 100, I think, is higher than any other country. And it's just a matter of, in the States, a lot of them want to follow the ones that are really, really at the top. They want to see another Andy Roddick holding a U.S. Open trophy. And it'll be interesting to see if one of these guys can break through, because that was the question for that generation after Andy and myself, for the Isners, the Querys, the Sox. Are they ever going to get a Grand Slam title? And the answer for them was no, but in singles. But for this generation, we'll see if one of them is possible to step up. I know we're finally now getting towards the end of the big three era, although Novak still has his hold on the number one ranking. You got Rafa looking like it's nearing the end of his career, Roger done. So there are more opportunities for some of these players to possibly get a slam. I know that last generation, it was really difficult for anyone to get any slams. So now maybe Taylor can get through to one. Francis, we've seen get to the semis. Tommy Paul has looked really, really good, and like the opportunity is there for him to get to the finals or maybe win a slam one day. And on the women's side, it's been so strong for so many years. You know, that was when we were even when we were playing and we were hearing where is the next Sampras, Agassi, Chang, Poirier, Todd Martin, all them. We had such a strong women's game between Serena, Venus, Lindsay, Jennifer Capriati. We had, you know, absolute greats, all-timers on the women's side. So our women were almost carrying the flag for the US. And it even went so far because Serena and Venus had such unbelievable longevity. So we had Grand Slam champions always on the women's side. And now we don't have Grand Slam champions as much right now, but we still have pretty good depth. And you know, there is the opportunity for some of the other Americans to do well. I mean, Sloane can still be dangerous. Madison Keys can still be dangerous. Kenin is making a comeback when we have, you know, obviously Grand Slam champions in there. So we do have the opportunities on the women's side, but it's great to see the depth on both the men and the women for the Americans.
And how about that Coco Gauff too, getting her first slam at the US Open last summer? I mean, that was just so special to watch too.
Yeah, and Coco, I mean, hopefully we'll be carrying the mantle for quite a while because she's still so young. I mean, people don't realize how young she is a lot of times because she started burst on the scene at 14, but at 19, winning a Grand Slam and already being a Grand Slam champion, you hope the pressure doesn't get to her, but it seems like she's got such a great head on her shoulders that those kind of things aren't going to hold her back. She's got a great team with her dad and mom have been so, so supportive, and they seem to be such a great fit in terms of helping her tennis career, where we haven't seen that as often with some other tennis parents. So it's so great to see that they've got such a great family structure, and now with the help of Brad Gilbert as well, doing really well in the coaching box. So I think for Coco, she's really putting it all together. And it's funny to think that people felt like it was taking her too long. There were so many questions of, is she ever going to win one? She was only 19 years old. She just turned 20. You know, she's got plenty of time. And I think she's going to rack up quite a few more. So it's good to see. But the top of the women's game also right now is extremely strong with Swiatek and Sabalenka and Rybakina, some really big hitters and some excellent talent. So it's going to be fun to see Gauff battling with them for the next 10, hopefully 10, 15 years. I mean, you see Venus Williams is still playing at 43 years old, I believe. So who knows how long Coco can play and can be near the top of the game.
Hey, if we have Venus out there at the age of 43, I mean, you're about that age yourself, I believe. How often are you still picking up a racket to play? I mean, the last time we saw you was here in Toronto, I want to say maybe 6 or 7 years ago with Andy and Jim and Robbie Ginepri.
Yeah.
And are you still doing some of those events, or are those sort of declining in frequency?
They're declining, I think, out of interest from the fans, and understandably so. We're moving much more in slow motion now, but you know, it's fun, and definitely Venus makes me feel like a slacker because she is my age and she's out there still playing when I've been the tournament director of Miami for 6 years. So it makes me feel like I maybe didn't get as much as I could have, but out of my career. But I know my body couldn't do it. I couldn't hang on. So now I really don't hit very much at all anymore. There's one kid from here in San Diego where I am that would get me out on the court. He just left for Stanford. He's playing at Stanford actually with Mary Jo Fernandez's son Nico Godsick. It's Hudson Rivera, and when he was in town I would hit with him, but now that he's at school I've almost never hit. I play a lot more pickleball than I play tennis nowadays.
Well, I was just going to ask you, and I was out playing pickleball with my son this morning, and it's funny because for the longest time I resisted, and I'm like, oh, I can't. I'm a tennis player. I'm not picking up a pickleball racket. But then you see Andre and Steffi, and Jeannie Bouchard's doing it now. So my son and I picked up a racket this morning, and boy, the two of us, like, he loved it absolutely because it's so immediate, accessible, right?
It's so easy to get into. And for me, one of the biggest things I love in life, especially loved it in tennis, was the feeling of getting better. Going out and practicing with a purpose and knowing that I can get better at something. And that applies to me with anything in life. If I go out and play golf, I want to find a way to get better. If I go out and play pickleball, I want to get better. And I can. I've gotten a lot better in pickleball over the last year, and that's fun for me to see. In tennis, I mean, sad to say, but I'm not getting any better. I can remember what I was doing at the US Open 15 years ago. I can remember how I was playing, but my body just can't do that anymore. So it's tough to say, okay, I'm going to go out and play tennis and get excited. The only thing really that makes me feel so excited about tennis when I do play is helping others. You know, so when I hit with someone like Hudson and seeing him, the progress he made in the last 3 years, not because of me, but just because of everything he was doing, the hard work he was putting in, but seeing him get better and me being able to hit with him and see his improvement, that's fun for me. For me to go out and try to work on my serve or work on my backhand, not nearly as much fun as it used to be. So it's fun for me if I have the right reason to get out and hit. And also get a good workout. That's another thing that's a good, you know, it's good to have excuses to work out because at this time, you know, all the hours I put in the gym and on the track and on the field, similarly, it's not as exciting to get up and go for a 5 mile run. So if I can get out and play tennis for an hour and have some fun, that's definitely easier.
Yeah, I hear that too. And hey, look, there's plenty of video evidence of you in your peak years still out there, and as well your book. And I want to mention it just briefly before we end, because I got to apologize, it took me so long to read it. But for me, I do things kind of sequentially, you know, like chronologically. So I had to get through other American male tennis player books first, like Connors and Sampras and Agassi. And I had yours there. And I'm like, okay, now I'm ready for that era. And for those who haven't read it, it's Breaking Back: How I Lost Everything and Gained Back My Life. And it just grabs you from the beginning and doesn't let go. And obviously, the relationship between you and your father was such a key component to the book. And as someone who's very close with my dad, that really, you know, I could relate to that. And it really pulled on the heartstrings. And I mean, I remember the challenges you went through as you were going through them as a tennis fan. But then when you read them all together, you're like, holy smokes, like all that happened in such a short amount of time. And your resilience and your positive attitude, I mean, I think it's a message that just, I mean, we got to give that to the tennis players that don't know you, because they're going to go through challenging times. And what an inspirational story. The book came out many, many years ago. You've written another one called Ways of Grace: Stories of Activism, Adversity, and How Sports Can Bring Us Together. But I guess to round up a very lengthy question, looking back on that book years later, you know, how do you feel it stands up now in terms of what you went through? And would you ever write a follow-up in terms of how your tennis career sort of ended, and how you're still involved in tennis and moving beyond that time?
Yeah, well, let me answer both parts of those. One is I felt like it was an unbelievable process. I was happy I did it because the way it is now, the fact that you can read it now and it's not so dated because it was just about the tennis. It was really about you hit it on hit the nail on the head. It was about my relationship with my dad and the things I went through. And way more people in my experience can relate to family tragedy, loss, tough times in life, and recovery. Much more than they can relate to hitting a forehand in front of 20,000 people and hearing the crowd go wild. That's a very select group that can relate to that. So the fact that more people nowadays can still pick that book up and relate to it, especially I've said it and it's self-promotional, I'll admit, but like it's the type of thing you can give for a Father's Day present because to see the relationship that my dad and I had and what I lost in that time in an important moment in my life. That speaks to people a lot more, and hearing people that tell me that they related to that book means a lot more to me than people coming up and saying, "Oh, I saw you play this match, and you did great in this match," because it's a much more human experience. And to say, would I write another book about the rest of my career and everything? I always said, so I did write that second one, but even when I wrote the first one, people asked, "When are you going to write the second one?" So I hope I don't have to write a second one because what happened to me at that time to make me feel like I should write a book, you know, all those things that happened. I when I first thought about writing a book, I'm like, how crazy is this? I'm 25 years old and I'm going to write a memoir. Like that, I haven't done anything to make that worthwhile until I started thinking about the things that I went through and how that can hopefully inspire other people. But if I have to go through things like that again to write another book, I hope I don't ever have to write another book. And then the next one happened after my incident with the New York Police Department. And when that happened, there's a chapter in that book called The Accidental Activist because I didn't seek out being an activist, but because of what happened to me, it was sort of thrust on me. And that's why I wrote the second book. And so now again, I say I don't want to have to write a third book because it seems like things have to happen to me for me to write a book. So right now, you know, I don't think anyone cares to read a book about taking my kids to soccer practice, you know, picking them up from softball, doing the parent teacher conferences, and things like that. So I hope I don't have to write another book anytime soon, but you never know. I don't say never.
I hear what you're saying. Although, hey, the adversity we face as parents, that's a real adversity too in terms of day-to-day
Yes,
battles, isn't it?
it is.
Just getting my kids to hockey practice sometimes, that's the biggest battle I have all week long.
Yeah.
One last thing about that book, and I really enjoyed, remembering what the J Block meant to you, that group of friends, family, and fans all kind of intermixed together. And, we talk sometimes about how difficult it is for tennis players to adjust to retirement, but I kind of wonder, tongue in cheek here, but like, what was it like for the J Block to retire after you stopped playing? And what are they up to now? And how much contact do you still have with all of them?
Well, that's actually a really hilarious question because, first of all, I've heard from at least five or six of them at different times individually to say that I ruined the US Open for them because now they don't want to go back and watch because they
It's
used
not
to
the
go
same.
for about 10 years, 12 years. They would come to watch me and they would, have too many drinks, but get so excited, maybe take the next day off work, whatever. But like they had something so invested in that now to go back, they're just like, I don't really feel like going. So I've ruined it for them. I apologize. But they're the people I'm still closest to. I'm going to see two of them in Miami. One of them's coming out here for him and his family's kids in their spring break right after the Miami Open. I still see, I mean, I'd say I'm on group texts with them pretty consistently. It's people didn't realize, I think people always just thought, oh, those are just some crazy fans. Those are the people that meant the most to me in my life. That when I was down, when I was not doing well, they were the ones that brought over dinner. They were the ones that got me out of my house. They were the ones that tried to put a smile on my face. And so those are the people that will be with me and close to me for my entire life. So J Block is always a part of my life. Not crazy, going nuts, having too many Heinekens and good, having a good time there. They've all matured. They've all now got kids and families of their own and stuff. But our bonds will always stay close.
Oh, it's great to hear that, and thanks for filming. And I was always curious what happened to those guys and girls.
Yeah.
And every tennis player should be so lucky to have a rabid fan base like that. It makes me think a little bit of those Carrot Tops that follow Jannik
Yeah.
Sinner around now too.
Yeah. Yeah. I see them there. That's a pretty cool group too.
Hey, thank you so much for taking the time. I've enjoyed this immensely. You inspired me when I was growing up,
Likewise.
watching the sport as a fan. You inspire me now, even working on this side of things. And I got to check out your second book. So that's definitely
Yeah.
next on my list in terms of, it's just so motivating. And that's you in a nutshell. I think that's the word that describes you. Our listeners are better off for having heard from you again now. So I hope we can keep this tradition up and have you on again one day for your Canadian listeners and other listeners around the world. Best of luck with the Miami Open this year and a very successful 2024 all around for you.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it, Mike.
There you have it, Mike's conversation with former American tennis player, commentator, author, and tournament director of the Miami Open, James Blake. And I hadn't really thought of, I obviously know it's a very challenging role being a tournament director, but you don't think about that perspective of being that former player and probably in James Blake's shoes, being buddy buddy with a lot of the players who are coming through to the tournament and probably sometimes expecting favors and expecting him to say yes to every possible request. And I found that really interesting that that's probably one of the biggest challenges he has is he can't fulfill every need and every request of every player that's coming to his event.
Yeah, it's funny. I kind of asked that question almost in jest about how, oh, it must be tough not to be able to do everything or get all these requests. But no, that in fact was his number one, I don't want to say beef, but challenge of the job was getting
Yeah.
those requests. Although it's funny to me that he said that's happening kind of less and less because there's less players out there that he was, playing against. They've retired as well. And he says it's more the coaches these days that he knows of the younger players that are now playing. So I'm sure it's the coaching requests who kind of come up and rub elbows and want the best practice time or the best practice courts or the matches played at, peak time for them and not necessarily for ratings or TV or what the tournament has in mind. But there's certainly a lot to juggle. And he does strike me as kind of a people pleaser and someone who would like to say yes to everybody, but you got to put your foot down sometimes. And that's the flip side of you got to be good cop, bad cop sometimes in that role, no doubt. I also found it funny his anecdote about a unnamed young WTA player who last year didn't realize that he was even a former player. And I guess it kind of ages me and dates me a little bit because I can't imagine anybody not knowing James Blake. But of course, as a new generation comes around, you might not be up to speed on your tennis history.
No, exactly. And he was always I thought he was one of the most likable players at the time when he was on tour. He had a great personality. He was, of course, an incredible player. Memories of amazing US Open runs, that quarterfinal, a thrilling match back in the day with Andre Agassi on those courts at Flushing Meadows. Probably fell victim to the greatness of Roger Federer a number of times, but still managed 10 career ATP titles in this fantastic career. And you think about the job he's taken on now. I mean, the Miami Open is one of the biggest tournaments on the tennis calendar, one of the nine biggest tournaments of the year for the ATP calendar. And that's a huge role for him. It was also cool for you to sort of connect and relate to him in terms of his tennis books, which he's written a couple now.
Yeah, one more a tennis book, and the other sort of more about, I think, off-court issues and equity and racism and things he's faced as well. And it just hammers home, like he said, he hopes he doesn't have to write another book because the books were more about the challenges and adversities he's faced. And my goodness, I think that man's already faced enough at such a young age, but just so inspiring. And I always go into a tennis book expecting it to be mostly about the on-court stuff, and clearly, that interests me as a tennis enthusiast and, someone who follows the sport closely. But in the book about, breaking back and regaining his life, it was really more about the off-court stuff and the challenges he faced and the family aspect to it too. And I really appreciated that because it made it different than your common tennis book that you read from former players about their careers.
No, definitely. I think as he touched on sort of the relatability of that, I loved hearing him speak so positively about Denis Shapovalov, who I've been trying to speak quite positively about him as he's sort of rebuilding and retooling for this year after, being set back by a knee injury, which kept him out post Wimbledon. And I think things are really turning a corner for Denis. So it's cool to know that James Blake has a personal connection to him as well.
And the fact that he sees similarities too, that Dennis went through that half season off, and James Blake was off for even longer, but at that sort of midpoint of your career, or sooner than you would expect. And Chapo's only what, like 24 years old? He's still got so many good years ahead of him, but a new adversity to face for someone that age, and hopefully having some new voices in his corner, it certainly can't help. I mean, it can't hurt, rather, sorry, to have a voice like James Blake, who you can touch base with as well. And I always feel like James Blake is a really calm kind of presence and individual. And I think we would both agree that that's probably something that Dennis could benefit from, because at times he gets quite heated and worked up and probably needs to hit that reset button mid-match to be able to rein things in and get back on track and get back into a match that, if not for a loss of concentration, he probably should be winning.
Yeah, 100%. That's well said. Let's segue that into Indian Wells, the first of the two Sunshine double events. And if we use the phrase back on track, I think that perfectly summarizes the last 10 days for Carlos Alcaraz, who has his first title since Wimbledon of last year. And what a fantastic event this was for him. I thought this was essentially the best version of Carlitos we have seen since he won Wimbledon last year. And to me, this was almost like a statement, like, I am back at my top level and I am to be feared.
Yeah, maybe that bee sting gave him some superpower or something that kind of, like zapped him back into, although he was already playing great in the event by the time that happened, which, by the way, was that not one of the weirdest things you've ever seen on a tennis
I've
court?
never
Those.
seen anything like that in my life. Let alone just that headline, just sort of play suspended bee invasion.
And that beekeeper dude that they had come in who kind of looked like Gene Simmons from Kiss. I mean, it was just, you couldn't have scripted this thing. It was just so absurdly bizarre. And anyways, getting back to the tennis, it was great to see Alcaraz back in fine form. And I mean, to me, it's so crazy how people quickly get on a player and focus on the negative, and that he had lost his way or was no longer being talked about as one of the top players on the tour. And my goodness, the guy's 20 years old. He's already got now as many Masters 1000 titles as Andy Roddick, Murat Safin, Jim Courier, and Boris Becker all have. They're tied with five, I believe it is. And yet people can talk about how, like, oh yeah, he's done, or he's, not going to be what we thought he was, or he's a flash in the pan. I mean, give the guy a break. Just because you're 20 years old doesn't mean you're going to have it together in each and every tournament. And to get wins over Sinner, Medvedev, Zverev, what an impressive display from him. And to capture his second now, tournament in Indian Wells. He's back, and he wasn't really gone for that long when you think about it either.
No, not at all, really. I mean, I know Wimbledon was the last title, but if you think about it, not long after that, he loses a 3-set, 3-hour, 40-minute match in the Cincinnati final. He was in the US Open semifinals, Australian Open quarterfinals. I think there's a lot of players on the tour who would happily sign up for that. So it's not like he's been losing first, second round at a bunch of events. He's been close. And yes, I think he had a slump for his standards. Sometimes tennis fans get used to such a particularly high standard that when a player is losing, you think something is wrong. But as you said, like, what a difficult draw that he worked his way through. Multiple top five players in succession, Zverev, who's now up to number five in the
Felix
world,
Auger-Aliassime as well.
Felix early on, who I know Felix isn't playing his best, but that was like he kind of got hit off court by Carlos, which was he neutralized Felix's serve. And when they were competing from the back of the court in the baseline game, Carlos just had too much power and too many options that Felix could not keep up. And that was a pretty one-sided affair. And then to beat Zverev, Sinner, Medvedev, I know we'll talk about the early loss Novak Djokovic suffered, but it doesn't really get much tougher than that to win a Masters 1000. And he's now won five in his career. Second player to win five Masters 1000s or more before the age of 21. You have a guess at who the other is?
Rafa.
There you go. Rafael
No
Nadal.
hesitation there. I
No,
knew
no
it. I think it was
hesitation.
the way that you posed the question. I think you were kind of like, yeah, it's my guy.
it's the other Spaniard. But I also think, and I said this last year, like, look, Novak, we know. I still think. We'll talk about this. I still think he's going to win titles. I don't think he's done. He's
Oh,
going to be
yeah,
at the
for
top of the
sure.
game for sure. But
Look at
if
what
you're
this guy
looking,
did just last season. So come on. But at the same point, what the heck is going on, right? Like, is it partly he's just not playing enough events? Like, he hadn't played since the Aussie Open, and you got to get into more tournaments. And now he's taking off Miami, which to me is kind of odd. I don't know. Did he give a reason for why he's taking off Miami, or was it
said
just
scheduling issues, which I found very
when you've only
strange.
played two events? I don't really buy that. Like, is he so eager to shrug off the hard court season, only playing two events, the early hard court season, that he just wants to get on a different service and reset? To me, I would have thought, no, he's going to go to Miami for sure and try and rebound there. So it's kind of odd to me that he's not going there, to be honest. I am a little puzzled at what's going on behind the scenes a little bit.
It is only unusual. And look, last year he was selective about his schedule as well, and it turned out obviously fantastic. He had an incredible season, winning three of four Grand Slams. Last year he played Dubai before Indian Wells. Maybe it was a mistake to skip that, just to have sort of a lower stress ATP 500 to lead in. I think the troubling thing is like, you look at a couple of these losses. Luca Nardi, this is a player who was outside the top 100 a couple weeks prior, was losing to someone outside the top 450. I will say he played a great match. He probably, he played the match of his life, obviously. Great forehand, good baseline game. But Novak, you think normally with his C game is going to solve a player like that. And I felt like in the third, he almost faded away. He was returning poorly. He didn't have any crispness on his ground strokes. Even movement wise, he wasn't as sharp as he usually is. It was just a strangely poor flat match from Djokovic. And you remember he lost to Jannik Sinner in the semis of Australia, but he looked incredibly bad in that match too, just not himself. And now it's two times, arguably three times this season where we've seen Djokovic look a little off. And I think that brings up the age question. Is he's suddenly looking a little more vulnerable at age 36, turning 37 this year?
I just can't imagine that there'd be such a drop and change from last season. I just, he was so incredibly dominant. It was one of his best seasons ever, which is ridiculous. But so I don't buy it. So who knows what else is going on? And we never know what else is going on in terms of players, family lives and commitments. He's got kids, that's taking up time as well. I think we've seen from many returning players on the WTA tour and what it was like for Roger Federer when he was traveling with his four kids. The added pressure that undoubtedly puts on you as well in terms of mental carrying capacity and just what you're bringing with you to the events that you go to. So who knows what's going on there? I'm very interested to see, not that I'm in a rush to get to the clay court season, but that'll be one of the big storylines for me is, does he kick back into his, because he's one of the best clay court players of all time.
Yep.
He's one of the best every surface players of all time. And that's part of what makes him kind of unique is I think Djokovic, less so than with Rafa and with Roger, there was less of a little dip between the surfaces, even though those other two guys were incredible on all surfaces too. But so for me, when he gets back on the clay, how he's going to respond there and is he going to get back on track?
Yeah, and I still think he's going to be, he's that best of five monster. Like, I think if he's playing Luca Nardi in a best of five format, he probably solves this and works his way through, right? And he did that
How
a
about
number of...
this guy, though? This will be a match. You can never take this away from Nardi. Like,
Oh, of
he's going to be able
course.
to say he beat the best, arguably, male tennis player of all time.
Yep.
This is a story for the kids, the grandkids. This is like, you wouldn't be able to wipe that smirk off my face for the rest of 2024, even if I
No.
lost every match I ever played again that year, you know?
Oh, for sure. And maybe, hopefully, in his case, the opposite happens, that it propels his confidence and belief, and it turns into a great career for him. Let's talk a little bit about Daniil Medvedev. A great tournament. He's now been to the finals of Indian Wells consecutive years. He took time off. He skipped Dubai, another crushing loss in the finals of Australia, but he's obviously playing exceptionally well. And we had this like chippiness with Holger Rune when they were
I love
showing
it.
down in the quarterfinals. He rallied
I
to
love
beat
it.
Tommy Paul in the semis. Yeah, like Daniil is kind of right there. He's not winning, but it seems like he's at the tail end, the business end of every tournament he plays.
Yeah. And, it's the opposite of the business end that I like about him when he's being kind of snarky on the court. And when he's,
Yeah.
I mean, boy, he hiked those shorts up awfully high, didn't he? To mock Holger Rune in that match. And I love that personality. I love that playfulness. I love that little edge to him. And we've had him on the podcast before. We had him on last
Yeah.
summer. Feel free to go back if you didn't check out that interview with Daniil Medvedev from the National Bank Open in Toronto. And he's just so insightful. And there's a lot of like there's a depth to him and the way he analyzes the game and the way he likes talking about the game. I don't know if you feel the same way, but after you get a player on the podcast or you get to interview a player at a tournament and they open up to you and they really give the best of their time to you, you can't help but in some way, shape, or form, kind of like, I don't know if root for them is the right way of saying it, but just kind of like have a different appreciation for them moving forward.
Definitely. And I would say right now, he might be my most favorite player to listen to impress. Because as you said, he
Same.
has such an analytical mind. I think he's really bright and really intelligent. He knows how to get the best out of his tennis. Very fun to see. Like, Holger Rune has a big personality too. So I love when you have two big personalities on the court. And we need, like, I love the Sinner-Alcaraz rivalry, but those two are so chummy and they love each other.
Oh
It's
yeah, they're
nice to
smiling at each other after
Oh
nice
yeah.
shots and everything.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's nice to have a little chippiness now and then.
I
So
agree.
that was fun for sure, and another good result for Daniil. We'll see what he does in Miami. Before we get to that, should shift over to the women's side. I don't know what your top 10 was leading into Indian Wells for Tennis Canada in terms of contenders. I put Iga Swiatek first. I just
Yeah,
feel
me
like
too.
these events, the way she's been playing, she's had two hiccups on the season. But ultimately, she's 20-2 overall. She's won two titles now and just picked up her eighth WTA 1000 with a second Indian Wells title. And she didn't drop a set through the 10 days. Like, she was completely dominant.
Yeah, it's going to take a lot for someone to, push her off the perch for me, even though I mean, the real blip she had this year, I guess, was at the Aussie Open falling in the third round. But she ended 2023 in such dominant fashion. And like you said, she's got two titles now. She made the semis in Dubai as well. In this one, I mean, she handed out a bagel or a breadstick in every match in each of her straight set wins en route to the title. So, yeah, to me, when I gave my power rankings for Tennis Canada ahead of this event, I forget how the others played out there, but yeah, she was an easy number one for me to put at the top. And she's won the Sunshine Double before back in 2022. So going into Miami, heavy favorite again. And if you've won those two tournaments once, it's got to give you so much confidence to be able to do it again. And, and then look at someone who's again super, super great on clay. I mean, she's got to be feeling pretty darn good about herself right now at this part of the year.
Yeah, and look, I always think she is the best player at this stretch of the season overall. Obviously, Aryna Sabalenka plays incredibly well in Australia. We know that. But you look through what she's done when she had her 38-match winning streak the other year. It was through sort of this block with Dubai and Doha and going through the Sunshine Double, leading into clay, where she is clearly, without a doubt, the most superior clay court women's player on the planet. When she gets on a run like this, like, I wouldn't be stunned to see another one of those huge winning streaks. And it really feels like someone has to do something very special to stop her. It was interesting to see Caroline Wozniacki put up such a great fight against her. It was unfortunate she had to withdraw and retire from their match due to foot blisters. That was early in the second set, but she was up 4-1 against Iga in that first set. So Świątek had her back against the wall a little bit there. But other than that, you look at the final she played against Maria Sakkari. They were 4-4 in the first set. Iga gets ahead, takes that first set 6-4, and then just steamrolls through the second. It's like once you give her an inch, she takes a mile. And yeah, it's so impressive.
There's no looking back. It's like when she played Bianca, it was a year ago, I guess, and Bianca played her so tight in the first set. It was a tie break. She really looked to have Iga kind of on the ropes and a little bit worried. And then it just, from there, you know, something clicked in Iga and there was no looking back as well. And I should mention before I forget that Bianca was on site in Indian Wells,
yeah,
you know, where she, I can't believe it was 5 years ago, where she had that initial huge victory that, I mean, winning the US Open, I don't think shocked people as much as her winning Indian Wells. That was really her coming out party 5 years ago. And it was nice to see her back there, but unfortunately it wasn't with the tennis racket really in her hand. So, you know, I think I've seen photos and videos of her practicing on clay lately. So it would seem to me like she's targeting hopefully a return for the clay court season. But yeah, I think the tennis tour is better, and certainly the Canadian tennis landscape is better when Bianca is out there playing. I kind of just hijacked your Iga chat, but
no, that's yeah, fine. Look,
I think there's only so many compliments we can throw her away anyways at this point.
Yeah,
I am super excited for Miami. The women's draw is out as we're recording this, and there's some mega matches already, as there always seems to be in the women's side, including a returning Simona Halep, who opens against Paula Badosa, winner to play Aryna Sabalenka.
Wow.
That is craziness right there.
That's
welcome
huge.
Back. Welcome back to the WTA.
No kidding. Were you surprised? Like, she so immediately announced herself as returning to the tour. Like, I thought there might be a little period of time for Simona Halep after she was cleared to play again before she actually returned to a tournament.
Well, to me, it tells me a couple things. One, just so, you know, flipping hungry she is to get back out there.
Yeah.
No doubt she's been practicing and training hard over the last while. I wonder if there was an inkling that maybe things were going to get reduced, or that there was a good chance and she knew the date that that conversation was going to happen. So she was gearing up in case things went, as it turns out they did, in her favor. So it doesn't surprise me. And knowing Simona Halep, and I mean, she's what, 32, 33 now. She also realizes that the window is only going to be there for so long for her to get back into the swing of things. She's been gone for what, almost 2 years, I believe, which is, you know, quite a lengthy time to be away from the game. But, you know, she looks super fit. She's got to be super hungry, chip on her shoulder, no doubt, to go out there and prove that she still belongs at the top of the game. And I expect, not necessarily in the first tournament back, but I think Simona Halep still has a lot that she can contribute to the game at a high level.
Well, if you think too, when that suspension happened, I would say it happened almost at the second peak of her career, because she was playing so incredibly well. And we saw her win that trophy in Toronto, and it looked like she was going to be a US Open contender, back to her very best. That partnership, of course, with Patrick Mouratoglou eventually blew up as a result of maybe this doping suspension, which is now gone. I think she's a formidable player, and the fact that she's getting this lead up tournament into the clay, where if there's a player I could say who, if she's at her best, could challenge Iga Świątek on a clay court surface, I mean, maybe it is Simona Halep. We probably should talk a bit about the Canadians before we wrap up in terms of Indian Wells and Miami. Layla Annie, I had pretty high hopes for her at Indian Wells. I don't know if she doesn't particularly love the conditions, because she hasn't really produced the results of late, but going out first round to young Frenchwoman Diane Perry in straight sets, in three sets, 7-5, 5-7, 6-2, a bit disappointing. And I think a bit disappointed that Layla was not able to sort of dictate play through most of this match, where you feel like she has more weapons on the court than her opponent.
Yeah, she got my hopes up back in Qatar when she made the quarterfinals, losing to Rybakina after beating Zhen Qinwen, Paula Badosa, Samsonova as well. And now it's kind of like three tournaments in a row of only one victory to show for it. So, will the real Leilani Fernandez please stand up? Because I think she's got, just so much talent, and you want to see it on a consistent basis. I guess, the thing is, when you think about it, aside from the Swiatek, Alcaraz, Medvedev, Sinner, like how many players are out there that are consistently producing those results that you want to see? I feel like probably many fan bases, when they look at their players, think, oh gosh, why can't they do that in, week in and week out? And it's just so tough to be able to do that because of the depth of talent that exists out there.
And look, I mean, especially the women's tour, there's been a lot of volatility. I can only imagine, if you're a passionate Ons Jabeur fan, how you're feeling about her right now. The struggle she's going through. Suddenly you're getting hopeful about Maria Sakkari, who's partnered with Jessica Pegula's former coach and now makes a huge final at Indian Wells. If you're a Pegula fan, how are you feeling about her? She's really struggling at the front end of this season. I think the good thing is you can really quickly turn the page. I like Layla's tennis on clay as well if Miami doesn't work out. And then, for Canadian hopefuls, ideally, let's say Layla is getting herself back in form and Bianca is returning to the tour healthy on clay, and suddenly we have two strong players on the women's side. I think Denis Shapovalov is starting to turn a corner as well. Like, he loses a very tough three-set match right at the tail end to Lorenzo Musetti, who's a fantastic player. Felix gets a win in that first round before losing to, obviously the dominant Carlos Alcaraz. So I think the tide is starting to turn. If we touch on Milos Raonic for a moment, again, he gets a win and then pulls out before facing Holger Rune in that second round.
So frustrating. You feel for him. And again, talk about a player that we've had lengthy chats with over the course of the last 6 to 8 months since he's come back on the tour. And so we know firsthand how much this means to him and how much he wants it. And it must be just so incredibly demoralizing and frustrating that it seems, well, it doesn't seem. He's played, what, three tournaments so far this year, and he hasn't been able to complete any one of them on his own terms, unfortunately. I know with the clay season coming up, he had aspirations to play the clay court season because he does want to qualify for the Olympics in Paris, which are going to be held on clay. I wonder how realistic that is. And if you're already struggling with, your physical state, just going back to a surface that historically had challenged your body, does that make sense too?
It feels like an unnecessary risk. And I don't know if part of the reason we're seeing Milos play despite not being at full health is he is kind of chasing that spot to be eligible for the Olympics and really desperately improve his ranking. And he
Desperate.
did,
Yeah, exactly.
yeah, he did accomplish that, I suppose, by playing Indian Wells and getting that one win, because he's jumped up 27 spots and suddenly he's back inside the top 200. So it does win you a lot, obviously, to get a victory at a Masters 1000. But then at what cost? Is it going to set him back for later? And there's not really a sign that he's going to be able to keep his body together for a full season. So then are you thinking, should we skip that clay season and try and maybe peak for grass? I don't know.
I mean, for me, if you're going to put your eggs in one basket and you're Milos Raonic, you're putting them in the grass court basket. That goes without saying. And I don't know, you get the feeling that it would be probably unlikely he continues beyond this year, the way things are going. And you knew how much it meant to him to get back last year and play Wimbledon. You know he wants to play there one more time again if he can.
Definitely. Before we wrap, this was a tidbit of news over the past week. Breakpoint on Netflix, which did enjoy two seasons, though I don't know ratings wise how successful, not being renewed for a third season. You surprised?
I mean, I don't know how many people enjoyed the seasons. They might have enjoyed the run at Netflix or whatever, the players who were involved. But I got to be honest, I didn't particularly enjoy it all that much. It fell way short of what I was hoping for. There wasn't enough drama. There wasn't enough, like, see a full match, to its, not its conclusion, but like, show us a match aside from just a couple of points, show us the ebbs and flows of a real tennis match. I don't know if they picked some of the wrong players in terms of personality. It just didn't click for me at all, and I wanted it to. And it didn't scratch the itch, unfortunately. And so it's not shocking to me that it's done after 2 years.
Yeah, I think it was a series. Obviously, the idea itself is fantastic, and we want to see the sport marketed and we want to see growth for tennis as much as possible. So I love the idea that a series is being picked up on Netflix. I think it missed the mark. I think execution-wise, maybe you had some people behind the scenes that don't necessarily know tennis. I thought they got some great names in terms of commentators, seeing Jim Courier, Prakash Amritraj, these guys discussing or breaking down portions of the season and why they're important. But in terms of tennis storylines and really capturing the viewer's eye, they sort of failed in that regard. And as you said, maybe highlighting the wrong players, a certain top 10 men's player who many people were very disappointed got a full episode dedicated to them in season two, highlighting a lot of Nick Kyrgios, which I eventually tired of. So disappointing. I am excited though, next year, Netflix documentary for Carlos Alcaraz. So let's hope they do that one right.
Yeah, hopefully they don't bungle that one up too.
No
But
kidding.
I will watch it, right? We'll watch it for sure, and we got high hopes. So hopefully they learn from this experience moving forward.
Hopefully. Thanks so much to James Blake, our guest for this week on the podcast. Guys, you've been listening to Matchpoint Canada. We will talk to you next time.